Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is The Sleep Pandemic. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. Imagine this. Imagine if you fell asleep, and when you woke up, almost all of your life had passed by. In what seemed like a few hours, more than 30 years had gone by. Your family, friends, and everything you knew and love had gone, and the world had changed into something that you no longer recognized. It sounds like a nightmare, or possibly the plot of some kind of science fiction movie. Maybe you think I'm about to tell you a story about how someone experienced a time slip, or some kind of paranormal event, like something from a Stephen King novella. No. Tonight's show is about something much more real, something grounded in science and entirely evidenced. Tonight we are going across the pond to the Bronx area of New York City. In 1969, there was a patient at Beth Abraham Hospital named Leonard Lowe. Leonard had not left the hospital in over 30 years. He was one of a group of patients who had been there since before many of the nurses who worked there and looked after him were even born. Leonard and the other patients that he was isolated with all suffered from a mysterious illness that had swept the country in the early part of the 20th century. The illness was one that had left all of them in a catatonic state, frozen inside their own bodies like human statues, completely unresponsive and immobile. For all intents and purposes, they looked dead, but they remained breathing. Nobody knew what was going on inside their heads. Their condition was new and completely baffled doctors and scientists alike. Were they conscious or unconscious? Or were they something in between? Vegetative zombies kept alive on an IV. Worse still, doctors even speculated that they may even be awake inside their own heads, yet unable to communicate, focus, move, eat, or anything else that we take for granted. Were they fully aware of what was going on around them? Just imagine that, being unable to get your body to talk to your own brain, sitting frozen solid for more than 30 years. Nobody knew what the hell was wrong with them. Then one day in March of 1969, Leonard and the others were going through their daily routines with the orderlies, food, cleaning, medicine and so on, when the doctor, Dr. Oliver Sacks, a pioneer and neurologist originally from London in the UK, came in with an oral medicine for each of the patients to take. There was nothing unusual about this. They were always tweaking the medication of the patients, and the doctors would regularly test different things to try to help their condition. The nurses didn't even ask any questions as to what it was. It was just routine. After Leonard took his medicine, they wheeled him into the recreation room, where the other patients were placed seated around the television. Not that they could watch or appreciate anything that was on, of course, but they just stared into the middle distance, seemingly frozen in position. They did the same most days, the same old routine. But on this particular day, after staring blankly at the television for around half an hour or so, Leonard suddenly woke up, and he started to talk. This was an astonishing moment for the doctors and nurses, who had only known him as being in a vegetative state for over 3 decades. Where had Leonard been this whole time? What was the sleeping sickness that had put him in this state? And what was the drug that got him out of it? And the most important question, could this happen again and to anyone else? You see, at the beginning of the 20th century, the world was changing fast. Things were evolving at a breakneck speed, and new technological and scientific breakthroughs came continually. The world had just crashed through the Industrial Revolution, and now science, medicine, and technology was playing catch-up. It really was a crazy time. The world at the turn of the century in 1900 looked like a completely different place to how it looked just 50 years later. I mean, just think about how many things happened in just a couple of decades. Things like people's homes got gas lines, and then indoor plumbing, and then electricity. Radio became a thing, and then movies, television. Cars were invented, then airplanes. Telephones and mass communication became a regular thing, and all of this happened in just 3 short decades. Then World War I brought untold devastation and killed more than 20 million people. This was followed by the Spanish flu, which arrived and killed 50 million more. Just to put that into perspective, the global population was around 1.6 billion at the time. So between World War I and the Spanish flu, around 5% of the whole world population was wiped out in just 4 short years. To add further perspective, for every 20 people that you know, at least one of them would have died from one of those two things. For all of the world's advancements, there was also huge devastation and tragic loss. But just as things were starting to settle down and the world looked like it was beginning to recover, a global Great Depression and an even bigger Second World War shook the world to its foundation. But somewhere in the midst of all that came one of the most strange, bizarre, and still to this day unexplained global pandemics of all time. A mysterious plague swept across the world, seemingly out of nowhere. It all started in the winter of 1916 in Europe, when patients began showing up in hospitals complaining of an extreme malaise, a complete and total lack of energy. Patients reported quickly diminishing energy and the sudden and rather overwhelmingly strong urge to just go to sleep. Some patients showed other neurological symptoms too, such as tremors, palsies, and hyperkinetic movements. And in some very extreme cases, patients quickly descended into the complete catatonic states, almost comatose, and unable to move or react to their environments. Human statues. Luckily, for most people, the illness ran its course, and they recovered and just went on with their lives, although many did also suffer some ongoing neurological damage. I'll touch on that later. But for an unfortunate few, a very small percentage of those affected by this strange new disease, the catatonic state that they had fallen into would become their permanent existence. Worryingly, more of these cases seem to emerge with quick regularity. The disease eventually received the attention of a doctor from the psychiatric neurological clinic of the University of Vienna, who had examined a handful of patients suffering with the disease. He would become the first doctor to write a scientific paper about the condition. His name was Dr. Konstantin von Economo. He wrote about it in a paper published in the journal Weinar Klinik Holzenesk in 1917. For clarity, this was Vienna's clinical weekly, for all of you non-German speakers out there. It was in this paper that Dr. von Economo, who sounds like a Marvel supervillain by the way, gave the disease its official name, encephalitis lethargica, often shortened to just EL, or more commonly referred to as the sleeping sickness. In the doctor's paper, he detailed several different types of the disease, something that he was able to because different patients under his care were presenting a little bit differently to one another. And because he was the first to publish, the name that he gave the condition kind of stuck, but so did his name with it. This is why you may also hear the disease referred to as the von Economo disease. He was not the last person to publish on this disease, however, not by a long shot. The French physician René Croucher was treating patients in a military psychiatric facility, and he published descriptions of the disease not long after von Economo as well. In all totality, there would be about 9,000 papers published on the subject of encephalitis by the mid-1920s. It fascinated many physicians and neurologists alike the world over, mainly because the disease baffled them. It was fairly unique, and it didn't behave like other diseases that they had seen before. They also couldn't pin down its origins. British epidemiologist F.G. Cruikshank published a paper in 1918 that listed several other epidemics that had looked a lot like encephalitis lethargica in the past. He referred to the German Kriebelkrankheit in 1672-1675, Raphonia, which occurred in Sweden from 1754-1757, and the sweating sickness in the United Kingdom in 1485. Encephalitis lethargica made its way to North America when the first case emerged in New York City on the 4th of September, 1918. Within a month, three other cases were also reported within the city. Encephalitis lethargica then spread quickly across the continental United States during the tail end of 1918, and by the spring of the following year, it had been reported in more than 20 US states. The disease actually peaked worldwide in 1923, when 2,000 cases ended up in fatalities in the US alone. There were by then quite literally millions of people suffering around the world with the infection, and come the mid-1920s, it was about as close as you can imagine to a real-life zombie outbreak. Hundreds of thousands of people lost the ability to walk, talk, and function with the disease, spreading further and further with nothing short of global domination in sight, eventually impacting more than 5 million people across the globe. Then, in around 1925, the disease just seemed to, well, stop. It ceased just as abruptly as it had emerged. With the exception of a small few, new cases stopped emerging, and those that already had the disease eventually overcame it, albeit with some remnant side effects in a small number of recoveries. Those who had suffered with it just went on with their lives. The whole epidemic was almost completely forgotten about, with the exception of a few questions which remained. One, the lingering question of what caused it. Two, the question of why and how it went away. And three, there remained a small number of people who unfortunately just didn't get over the disease and remained in a catatonic limbo that went on for decades and decades. Over the years, doctors studied these surviving patients, looking for clues of the disease's origin and pathology. And while most of it remained a mystery, and remains a mystery to this very day, some patterns did emerge in the patient data. Dr. von Economo classified encephalitis lethargica into three unique forms: amyostatic akinetic, hyperkinetic, and somnolent ophthalmoplegic. The least common of these three was the amniostatic akinetic. In these specific cases, people experienced rigidity for extended periods, though they were also aware of what was happening around them. Just their movements were very, very slow. As Dr. Von Economo wrote, quote,
"To look at these patients, one would suppose them to be in a state of profound secondary dementia. Emotions are scarcely noticeable in the face, but they are mentally intact."
Now, the hyperkinetic form presented patients with a manic phase at the onset, with involuntary jerking movements in their faces, hips and shoulders, and some involuntary vocalizations. But that was just the first phase. After that, they experienced fatigue, restlessness, and extreme weakness, which could last for several days at a time. It was during this phase that some of them who suffered would experience hallucinations and nerve pain in their faces and limbs. But the most common form of encephalitis lethargica was somnolent ophthalmoplegic. Its characteristics included confusion, delirium, and feelings of being in a dazed state. Other signs of the disease were cranial nerve paralysis and an overwhelming desire to sleep. Now, one interesting link that did get made by doctors at the time was between encephalitis lethargica and Parkinson's disease, which a lot of patients would go on to develop after the epidemic faded away. FYI, Parkinson's disease is a kind of an umbrella term for any neurological condition that causes stiffness, tremors, and slowed movements. So a lot of these encephalitis patients would recover, but then later develop a kind of Parkinson's, where they would become mentally and physically exhausted, their limbs would become rigid, their postures bent, and their walking and movement unsteady. All of this would happen over the course of a few months. This, of course, is not the same as how regular Parkinson's disease would present itself in patients. Because of this, doctors started to call it post-encephalictic Parkinson's disease, or PEP for short. Some of the differences between the two included where PEP would occur at any age, whereas Parkinson's occurs generally after the age of 50. PEP progresses rapidly and in spurts. Parkinson's kind of steadily and slowly progresses over extended periods of time. And there's no sign of what's referred to as, quote, pill-rolling tremors in PEP, which you often see in Parkinson's. For clarity, pill-rolling tremors are specific movements that make it appear like you are rolling a small pill between your finger and your thumb. The majority of these cases showed up during the 1920s, about 6 months to a year following the acute encephalitis diagnosis. Now, some studies suggest that the number of patients with Parkinson's symptoms actually tripled during this time, since there were as many PEP cases in the 1920s and 30s, many doctors believed that encephalitis caused Parkinson's disease. Some even thought that Parkinson's would disappear completely when the encephalitis generation died out. Whilst that would have been nice, that's sadly not what happened. Whilst many of them did die out over the years, many from complications from encephalitis and many from the Parkinson's just kept going, trapped in their faulty bodies year after year with no end or resolution in sight. Fast forward in time to the 1960s, where our story first began, where a small group of these chronic encephalitis survivors resided at the permanent care facility in Beth Abraham Hospital in New York City. Remember what the timeline is here. These patients had developed the disease in the 1920s. It was now 1966. 4 decades had passed. It was during this year that a new doctor came to work with these patients, a neurologist from England named Dr. Oliver Sacks. Sacks had just completed a residency in neuropathology at UCLA, and he was interested in exploring this and other neurological cases that he had read about. When he first arrived at the ward, Dr. Sacks described it as like entering a museum or a waxwork gallery. He would later write in his 1973 book titled Awakenings, quote,
"They would be conscious and aware, yet not fully awake. They would sit motionless and speechless all day, in their chairs, totally lacking energy, impetus, initiative, motive, appetite, affect, or desire. They register what went on about them without active attention and with profound indifference. They neither conveyed nor felt the feeling of life. They were as insubstantial as ghosts and pacifist zombies.
Sack said that they were motionless people fixed in strange positions, with everyone looking completely frozen. And that was kind of a characteristic of these patients. If you raised the patient's arm in the air and let go, they would just hold it there until you moved it back down again, no matter how long you left it there for. The patients reacted like posable figures. Real-life human statues. Then, in early 1967, a new treatment became available to treat Parkinson's disease. It was called levodopa, or L-dopa. The medication works by increasing the body's ability to produce the hormone dopamine in the brain, which makes it possible for your brain to then effectively transmit signals down the body's neural pathways. And this is one of the things that are the root causes of Parkinson's disease. Your body stops being able to produce new dopamine, and it screws up the communication signals in the brain's motor cortex. Thus, L-dopa is essentially a precursor to dopamine. It's a chemical your body needs to create the dopamine. So by giving Parkinson's sufferers L-dopa, it would help patients to produce more dopamine, which would slow down the progression of Parkinson's symptoms. Dr. Sachs described it as a kind of nutrient that serves to nourish and replace the missing dopamine in the human brain. It's a dopamine fertilizer, if you want to place a common misnomer to it. And as there is a documented connection between encephalitis and Parkinson's disease, Dr. Sachs began to wonder if maybe L-dopa would help with encephalitis patients too. It took Sachs a few years to get access to the L-dopa medication, and of course to obtain the required permission to actually test it on these patients. But finally, in March of 1969, Sachs was able to get his hands on it, and he administered the L-dopa to them. And it worked. As soon as the L-dopa hit the brain, the patients awakened and acted normally within minutes after administration. These patients who had been catatonic or just straight up asleep for 40 years suddenly came to life as if they had just awakened from an afternoon nap. They were conscious, they were coherent. They were able to move and walk and throw balls to each other. They spoke and chatted away. It was like a literal miracle. Now, obviously these patients were super excited to be back to their normal lives. But some actually didn't handle it very well at all. They were turned violent or regressed out of this transformation. They would go back into their sleepiness states. Dr. Sachs told Fresh Air magazine in 1985, quote,
"They were coming to and they were being awakened and animated, but often in a vacuum. They were off into a world which no longer made any sense for them, which had no place for them, a world in which they no longer had relatives, friends, or anything."
Think about it for a second. When these guys went into their catatonic states, the First World War had just ended. There were no aeroplanes, cars were scarce, and most homes didn't have electricity or indoor plumbing. Then just a few months after they awoke, man landed on the moon, and the Vietnam War was in full swing. Many of the patients would look in the mirror and be confused by the old person staring back at them. They didn't recognize their own reflections. Not to mention, the music and the fashion was outright strange and bizarre to them. Culture, politics, and society was entirely alien. Unfortunately, after several months of being awake and experiencing a new kind of life and getting to live again, the L-dopa began to wear off. Each dose produced less and less results. Its returns slowly diminished, and eventually the patients stopped responding to it altogether. One by one, they all returned to their catatonic states. You may have heard about this story before, or it may sound vaguely familiar to you. That's because Dr. Oliver Sacks and his story was turned into an Oscar-winning movie in 1990, starring Robert De Niro and Robin Williams. It's actually a great movie if you haven't seen it. You should check it out. This year will mark 100 years since the end of the encephalitis lethargica epidemic. 100 years have passed, and we still have no idea as to what caused it. Theories have generally fallen into two main categories: toxicological, and infectious, with a third theory having sprung up in recent years. The toxicological theory obviously suggests that the encephalitis epidemic was caused by an external toxin of some kind. For example, a suggestion that emerged in the UK thought that it was caused by botulism or solamine, toxins that collect in potato sprouts. But Dr. Von Economo actually ruled out toxic causes fairly early on, because none of the patients had any gastrointestinal issues upon examination and testing. The doctor also ruled out typhoid, polio, syphilis, and poison gas triggers. One thing that Von Economo did notice, though, was that all of the patients displayed flu-like symptoms, and since the world was just coming out of the Spanish flu pandemic, the doctor thought that it was possibly encephalitis triggered by the flu, so sort of like an influenza encephalitis virus. Fun fact, the Spanish flu was not actually from Spain. No, the Spanish flu is believed to have started in the United States, in Kansas specifically. The name Spanish flu came from the fact that Spain was just the first country to publicly report on the epidemic. I'm just going to pause the episode here to invite you guys who haven't already done so to head over to our Patreon and sign on up. It gives you access to extra episodes, articles, blogs, and research material, and all for just $2 a month. All that for less than the price of a cup of coffee. That's a hell of a bargain, I don't mind saying. If you're interested in joining us, head to www.patreon.com/deadsouls. We can't wait to see you guys over there. And for those of you who have already signed up, thank you so, so much. We are so ingratiated to have you with us. While you are there, reach out and say hello. Okay, now, back to the episode. There were previous instances of encephalitis associated with flu epidemics. Unfortunately, studies show that the brains of people who died from an influenza encephalitis had significant neuropathological differences than those who had died from encephalitis. But Dr. Von Economo still believed that an infectious virus had caused the encephalitis outbreak. There have been various studies that both prove and disprove the influenza theory, so it has never been proven either way. But that would also explain why the disease suddenly went away, about the same time as the influenza pandemic ended. So, I earlier mentioned a third hypothesis. It was put forward in the early 2000s, and the suggestion is that it was caused by a post-infectious autoimmune disorder. Scientists proposed that antibodies against NMDA receptors as a possible cause. NMDA is a receptor for the neurotransmitter glutamine. It stands for N-methyl-D-aspartate, and it helps with neuroplasticity. The suggestion being that the body is creating antibodies that are then attacking NMDA receptors, which in turn, to put it in layman's terms, causes the brain to short-circuit. A pediatric neurologist from the UK named Russell Dale suggested this hypothesis in 2003. He was working with around 20 patients who were currently infected with encephalitis when he noticed in their medical records that more than half of them had previously experienced a sore throat caused by a rare form of strep just prior to them becoming inflicted with the rare form of encephalitis. So, he hypothesized that these antibodies may have mistakenly attacked the basal ganglia neurons, thus triggering the chronic disease. Another hypothesis, proposed in 2012, stated that the encephalitis epidemic could have been caused by an enterovirus, or even the poliovirus. Enteroviruses enter the body through the gastrointestinal tract before attacking the nervous system. They can also be spread through the air and on contaminated surfaces, so they're highly infectious and transmittable. So, numerous theories, but no smoking gun. There are always gaps in the evidence to close the door, never providing a whole lot of answers. It's tempting to dismiss encephalitis lethargica as a bizarre medical outbreak from a century ago, but dismissal could be a potential calamity. Encephalitis lethargica still emerges in people from time to time. It very much hasn't gone away, and we know about as much now as we did back in the 1920s about it. Out of the tens of millions of people infected by the Spanish flu, a small percentage developed encephalitis, and of those, a tiny percentage never fully recovered. They fell asleep and just never woke up again. Encephalitis lethargica never fully left us. It simply retreated into the shadows. And with the recent COVID-19 pandemic, who knows if it, or something even more catastrophic, could return on a large scale once again. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.